And if the rest of us would turn to Revelation, now you suspected that. We're in Revelation chapter 17. This chapter and the next one are both kind of creepy. It is true. After 17 and 18, it starts to sound a lot more fun, doesn't it? In 19, there's like a hymn of vindication sung about Christ, and then we have Christ's return, the whole, you know, the white horse stuff. We're going to try to do 17 and 18 all together today, because it really all fits together. That's one of the hard parts of this. If we break it all up too much, you know, we're losing way too much continuity. So as long as we can all make it to like 4, we're good. All right? No jokes. Yeah, I got to keep it together. Hey, good luck on that one. Last week we did 15 and 16. Okay? And that was the seven bowls, the seven last bowls of the seven plagues, right? And we learned last week that God's judgment was at hand. Okay, and the last bowl included a terrible earthquake, an earthquake greater than any ever seen before on earth. It included huge hailstones, 100-pound hailstones. Okay, a hailstone that weighs 100 pounds would be a foot and a half in diameter, big things. And it talked about the destruction of the great city, and the collapse of all the cities of all nations. Now, Revelation 17 and 18 are probably, I think, most clearly understood as further descriptions of the destruction of the great city. Okay, in 15, we had the seven plagues. The last thing that happens is the great city is destroyed. And then 17 and 18 go into more detail of all that. So these are details of the final bowl. Now, as we read these chapters, we're going to see that the great city is Rome. One thing we're told that it sits on seven hills. Rome is the city that sits on seven hills. But it's described as a luxurious prostitute who meets a gruesome death. It's also this prostitute signifies religious apostasy, okay, turning from God. Throughout the Bible, we have prostitution being equated to religious apostasy. Israel turning from God. Hosea, for instance, marries an unfaithful woman as an illustration of God, an illustration of the people of God turning from God. Then the city, the destruction of the city is described as with this great funeral dirge, and kings and merchants and seafaring people mourn the loss of the city. See, they had earned their livelihood. They depended on Rome and Rome's insatiable need for extravagance. And they mourned the loss of their money, the loss of their incomes. Now, the city is called Babylon in the text. We see that name used a few times. Okay, but in this case, I would suggest Babylon is a symbol for Rome. Okay, it's a symbolic name. Now, one thing, in John's day, when the book of Revelation is written, when God gives John this revelation, Rome is the center of satanic power. It's the center of oppression against the church. Okay, now, Babylon had been conquered by Alexander the Great right around 331 BC. Alexander the Great conquered Rome. Now, Alexander wanted to preserve Babylon. But after Alexander died, he had four successors. These are four generals who become kings, and they just fight among each other. And one of the pieces of collateral damage in all the fighting is Babylon is destroyed. The successors fight over it. The battles kind of go back and forth across it. The city is eventually deserted. It is forgotten. The bricks and stuff that are used to build Babylon are taken away and used for other things. There's not a lot there of the city, even to this day. So it's not truly Babylon. Babylon in John's day is pretty much just gone. But Babylon signifies Rome. Babylon and Rome then represent any and all worldly and profane powers. It doesn't really matter what their name is, doesn't really matter where they are, but it represents profane worldly power. So, chapter 17, we're jumping in here, follows right along the seven bowls, the seven plagues. This is right after that. I'm going to read some text and then make some comments and keep and work our way down through this. Revelation 17:1. One of the seven angels who had the seven bowls came and said to me, "Come, I will show you the punishment of the great prostitute who sits on many waters. With her, the kings of the earth committed adultery, and the inhabitants of the earth were intoxicated with the wine of her adulteries." So this is this prostitute who represents the city, representing profane worldly power, who has led everyone else astray. Verse 3. Then the angel carried me away in the spirit into a desert. There I saw a woman sitting on a scarlet beast that was covered with blasphemous names and had seven heads and 10 horns. Okay, now this woman in the desert is the same prostitute. It was mentioned in verse 1 and 2. Now she's sitting on the beast from the sea. Okay, if you go back to Revelation chapter 13, where we saw the beast of the sea, you'll see that these two beasts are the same. The woman was dressed in purple and scarlet, was glittering with gold, precious stones, and pearls. She held a golden cup in her hand, filled with abominable things and the filth of her adulteries. This title was written on her forehead: Mystery, Babylon the Great, the mother of prostitutes and of the abominations of the earth. I saw that the woman was drunk with the blood of the saints, the blood of those who bore testimony to Jesus. When I saw her, I was greatly astonished. Okay, so this woman sitting on the beast, she's tied to the beast, you might say. She is adorned in luxury. She is adorned in splendor. She has luxurious clothes. And she is morally corrupt. And her titles is, say, like, for instance, mystery. A mystery is a secret meaning that is about to be revealed. Who is she? Well, we're about to be told. She's Rome, like Babylon. She's the mother of all obscenity. She's the mother of all shameful things. She has a lust for violence. And she's responsible for the slaughter of many believers. It's just truly evil. But now we get some more information. Verse 7. Then the angel said to me, "Why are you astonished? I will explain to you the mystery of the woman and of the beast she rides, which has the 7 heads and 10 horns. The beast, which you saw, once was, now is not, and will come out of the abyss and go to his destruction. The inhabitants of the earth, whose names have not been written in the book of life from the creation of the world, will be astonished when they see the beast, because he once was, now is not, and yet will come. At the time of John's writing, this beast had not yet come out of the abyss." It is the beast from chapter 13. This beast, if you remember, had had a death stroke, but yet he survived. The statement that he once was, now is not, and yet will come is like a cheap parody of Christ, who is and who was and who is to come. Verse 9, this calls for a mind of wisdom. It means we need to interpret it with care. We need God's wisdom to understand. And the angel goes on. The seven heads are seven hills on which the woman sits. They are also seven kings. Five have fallen. One is. The other has not yet come. But when he does come, he must remain for a little while. You know, as I mentioned, Rome sits on seven hills. The beast is a representation of Rome, just as the woman is. But there are two meanings to the seven heads. The second meaning is about seven rulers. Okay, now, they maybe are seven emperors of Rome. Maybe seven secular empires. Since the number seven is a number of completeness, maybe it's the power of Rome and all the power that Rome represents. The completeness of empires. No matter what the interpretation is, the end is drawing near. Five have fallen. There's one currently, and then one more. Verse 11, the beast who once was and now is not is an eighth king. He belongs to the seven and is going to his destruction. Now we repeatedly see this beast is going to be destroyed. It will be thrown into the abyss. He will go to his destruction, we see in verse 8. And now again, we are told he will go to his destruction. The beast from the sea represents an eighth king. He has not yet come. He is of the seven. NIV says he belongs to the seven, but he's not one of the seven. He is an eighth. He's like them, but he's distinct. I think this beast is not a human ruler. The other rulers are human rulers through whom evil finds expression, but this beast is evil ruling. It's the power of evil itself. I think that's important. We talk about the destruction of the beast. We're not just talking about the destruction of some evil power. Okay, I mean, pick your government if you want, and call it an evil government. Okay, it's not just the destruction of an evil government. It's the destruction of evil. The destruction of evil power. We'll go on. By the way, if you want to dive farther into this with me sometime, we can talk more about all of these. The possibilities of what this could mean go on and on and on. What I'm trying to offer you is what I think is like the clearest way to put together whether this is symbolic or whether this is literal, as we've done with all the book of Revelation. Verse 12. The ten horns you saw are ten kings who have not yet received a kingdom, but who for 1 hour will receive authority as kings along with the beast. They have one purpose and will give their power and authority to the beast. They will make war against the Lamb, but the Lamb will overcome them because he is Lord of lords and King of kings. And with him will be his called, chosen, and faithful followers. Then the angel said to me, the waters you saw where the prostitute sits are peoples, multitudes, nations, and languages. Okay, so the ten horns are ten kings from all over the world who represent powers of nations on earth. And they're going to be subservient to the beast. There is great conjecture over trying to identify the ten. And depending on what century you live in, that's how you're going to try to define them. Okay, now, 10 is another number of completeness. I don't know that we need to try to identify who they are. The point, theologically, is that the world is going to follow this beast. They're going to give their power to the beast, and they're going to make war against Christ. The Lamb is obviously Jesus. Now, we can keep insisting on trying to identify who the ten are. I really don't know that we need to know. When it happens, we'll know. But they are hostile to Christ. They are hostile to Jesus. They want to make war against him with the beast. I mean, Satan, if there's anything he does, is he makes war with Jesus, or he tries to. He opposes Christ. And of course, the Lamb will win. The Lamb will overcome them. Which, by the way, is Revelation chapter 19. We'll talk about that next week. We find that the nations of the world come together to fight the Lamb, and Jesus gives them battle, so to speak. And I'll jump ahead and I'll tell you the end of the story. Jesus wins. Of course, we were told 100 times in this thing, maybe not 100. We were told many, many times in this already that Jesus is going to win. And he does. And it's not really a battle. They don't really come close, right? It's like a mosquito trying to stop a Mack truck that's going downhill at 120 miles an hour with no brakes, fully loaded. It just gets smashed. The beast, verse 16, the beast and the ten horns you saw will hate the prostitute. They will bring her to ruin and leave her naked. They will eat her flesh and burn her with fire. Now, that's not a fun thought. Okay, so the beast out of the sea and the ten horns, which represent these ten powers that are giving their power to the beast, they will turn on the prostitute. They'll make her desolate. They will shame her. They will attack her. Eating her flesh, maybe they're going to feed her to animals. Maybe they're literally going to eat her. Now, that's just kind of gross, but... Or at least figuratively, they are destroying her. The beast destroys the woman who serves him. The beast is evil, pure evil. This describes the self-destroying power of evil. Wickedness gives way to jealousy and hatred, and evil people often destroy each other. Satan wants the destruction of those who follow him. He doesn't want to help anyone. Satan doesn't even want to help his followers. He wants their destruction. What a contrast with Christ, the Lamb. Verse 17, for God has put into their hearts to accomplish his purpose by agreeing to give the beast their power to rule until God's words are fulfilled. The powers of evil serve the purposes of God. Even evil is not independent of God. And then verse 18, the woman you saw is the great city that rules over the kings of the earth. The city will be destroyed. And then so will the beast and those who follow him. So I move to chapter 18, and this is like another parallel of the whole thing. Okay, it's like funeral dirges, laments being sung. And it's interesting, as John is writing this, he is a prisoner of Rome on a desolate little island. Rome is, you can argue whether that is absolute pinnacle of power, but it's thriving. It's around the height of its power. It's in its glory. Rome rules the world as far as John can tell, the whole world. And John's a prisoner of it on a little deserted island. And yet John talks about Rome's fall, not his own. And he talks about it like it's in the past. It's a done deal. It's a sure thing. Evil will not reign forever. Only God reigns forever. So let's read these. John goes on, 18 verse 1. I saw another angel coming down from heaven. He had great authority, and the earth was illuminated by his splendor. Wouldn't that be cool to see? Okay. Verse 2. With a mighty voice he shouted, "Fallen, fallen is Babylon the Great. She has become a home for demons and a haunt for every evil spirit, a haunt for every unclean and detestable bird. For all the nations have drunk the maddening wine of her adulteries. The kings of the earth committed adultery with her, and the merchants of the earth grew rich from her excessive luxuries." Okay, the real reason for the fall of Rome, it will fall just like Babylon did, and the real reason is because of her evil, and that she led the world to evil. Verse 4, I heard another voice from heaven say, "Come out of her, my people, so that you will not share in her sins, so that you will not receive any of her plagues, for her sins are piled up to heaven, and God has remembered her crimes." You know, this is spoken to the people of God. The city's sins have piled up, and punishment is due. And the people of God are supposed to flee. Get out. Get away. The destruction of the city is coming. The righteous and the wicked don't belong together. The believers should not share in her sins and then should not receive her plagues. As the church is persecuted, as the church lives in the world under persecution or not, we are always faced with the temptation to compromise, to be worldly. Under persecution, it's tempting to compromise in order to ease the persecution. And we see that today, don't we? For the people in the Middle East, when ISIS comes in, if they will confess following Allah, I assume they'll be saved. They won't be killed. For us, how much more tempting is it getting every day just to deny Christ? If there is one thing our culture doesn't like, it's a Christian who wants to use Jesus' name. But we have to be patient. We have to endure. That's what we're called to do. We're called to reach into the world, not be like the world. We have to be around it. This is not a call to crawl into a hole and ignore the world. Although at the point of destruction, we're called out. But we are not to be like the world. We are not. We have to be different. Like salt, like yeast, like light. Light and darkness don't have anything like each other. Salt changes the taste of things. Yeast changes what happens in a loaf of bread. Do you ever make bread and forget to put the yeast in? They call it matzah. But it's just not quite the same, is it? Okay. So now this voice that had called out to the people of God in verse 6 speaks to the agents of divine vengeance, and he says to give the city repayment in kind. Judgment is just. She's getting back what is due her. Verse 6. Give back to her as she has given. Pay her back double for what she has done. Mix her a double portion from her own cup. Give her as much torture and grief as the glory and luxury she gave herself. In her heart she boasts, "I sit as queen, I am not a widow, and I will never mourn." See, there she thinks she's beyond the possibility of loss, beyond the possibility of sorrow, but now her pride brings her low. Her misery is in proportion to her self-glorification. Her misery is in proportion to the luxurious lifestyle she had chosen. Verse 8, therefore in one day her plagues will overtake her. Death, mourning, and famine. She will be consumed by fire, for mighty is the Lord God who judges her. In one day. Rome at the time of this writing seems truly beyond loss or sorrow. But in one day it will all be gone. So now we get to these three laments. In each one, people weep, they mourn for the destruction of the city, but not for the city's sake. I've been to funerals, and we mourn for the loss of the person. We feel sorry for the people who are missing a loved one. This is a different kind of mourning. The people weep for what they are losing. They don't care any more for the city than the beast did. They care for their own evil desires, not for the city itself. In each group, no one tries to help the city. No one tries to help. They stand at a distance. And in each time, they're astonished that the destruction can come so quickly. It's an important point that they don't really want to help, but they just can't believe how fast she falls. So verse 9, when the kings of the earth who committed adultery with her and shared her luxury see the smoke of her burning, they will weep and mourn over her. Terrified at her torment, they will stand far off and cry, woe, woe, O great city, O Babylon, city of power. In 1 hour your doom has come. The merchants of the earth will weep and mourn over her because no one buys their cargoes anymore. Cargoes of gold, silver, precious stones and pearls, fine linen, purple, silk and scarlet cloth, every sort of citron wood and articles of every kind made of ivory, costly wood, bronze, iron and marble. Cargoes of cinnamon and spice, of incense, myrrh and frankincense, of wine and olive oil, of fine flour and wheat, cattle and sheep, horses and carriages, and bodies and souls of men. They will say, the fruit you long for is gone from you. All your riches and splendor have vanished, never to be recovered. The merchants who sold these things and gained their wealth from her will stand far off, terrified at her torment. They will weep and mourn and cry out, woe, woe, O great city, dressed in fine linen, purple and scarlet, and glittering with gold, precious stones, and pearls. In 1 hour, such great wealth has been brought to ruin. We go on. Every sea captain and all who traveled by ship, the sailors and all who earn their living from the sea will stand far off. When they see the smoke of her burning, they will exclaim, was there ever a city like this great city? They will throw dust on their heads and with weeping and mourning cry out, woe, woe, O great city, where all who had ships on the sea became rich by her wealth. In 1 hour, she had been brought to ruin. Again, laments, but what they lament is their loss. Verse 20. Rejoice over her, O heaven. Rejoice, saints and apostles and prophets. God has judged her for the way she treated you. We had heard long ago the martyrs saying, when God? Well, now. Rejoice, heaven. Rejoice, martyrs. God has given righteous judgment. He's returned to Rome, which she has dished out. Throughout this book, evil has had a chance to repent. Evil has had a chance to turn to God, and it keeps refusing. And then judgment comes. And we see the destruction from another view now. Verse 21. Then a mighty angel picked up a boulder the size of a large millstone and threw it into the sea and said, with such violence, the great city of Babylon will be thrown down, never to be found again. Sudden, spectacular destruction that will be caused by God. Like being picked up and hurled into the sea, the boulder plunges into the depths, permanently gone. The destruction is complete and is forever. And then, as we go on here a little bit about the complete permanent destruction. The music of harpists and musicians, flute players and trumpeters will never be heard in you again. No workmen of any trade will ever be found in you again. The sound of a millstone will never be heard in you again. The light of a lamp will never shine in you again. The voice of bridegroom and bride will never be heard in you again. No music, no economic work, no food, no rejoicing, no light. Permanent and complete destruction. The second half of verse 23. Your merchants were the world's great men. By your magic spell, all the nations were led astray. In Hur was found the blood of prophets and of the saints and of all who have been killed on the earth. This whole two chapters talks about Rome as the center of corrupt, godless power, with a lust for violence and an insatiable appetite for extravagance. Part of her problem is how extravagant she lives. And a couple thoughts as we close. I mean, I look at that. I think, don't we as a society at least partially resemble that? What about our extravagance? We need God. Our country needs God. We need a revival. We need an awakening. You know, it looked like Rome was too great and too powerful to fall. She was beyond the possibility of loss or sorrow. But the city was destroyed suddenly and completely. Evil often looks too powerful to lose. As we face evil in life, as we see it around us, it just seems too powerful. Corrupt, godless power often seems impossible to stop. And from a worldly view, maybe it is. From a worldly view, maybe it is. But God does have the upper hand. And that's one of the main points of all this. I mean, the destruction is terrible to watch. But God is more powerful than Satan. He's more powerful than the beast. He's more powerful than the beast with the 10 nations that align with him. Is more powerful than all evil. His triumph is sure. We need to stay patient. We need to keep following Christ. We need to patiently endure. And next week we start to see the results of patient endurance. Next week, we start to see the return of Christ and then all that happens when he comes back. It's a great, wonderful day that we wait for. But for anyone not living for Christ, it's going to be a horrible day. worse than anything anybody's ever imagined. For us, that ought to be a call to examine our faith. Are we following Christ? And it ought to be a call to think of our friends, our loved ones, our neighbors, our family, the ones who just are not following Christ. Are there ways we can share with them? Are there ways we can tell them about Jesus? We can pray for them and pray for ways to share. Pray for others to come and share.